And now, WCHL presents a special edition of Who's Talking. Our guest host is Jeff Danner, substituting for D.G. Martin. And now, here is Jeff Danner.
Hello, and welcome to Who's Talking. This is Jeff Danner, author of the blog Common Science on ChapelWorld.com. Today, I'm substituting for D.G. Martin, and my guest is Amy Sale, current science program manager at the Moorhead Planetarium. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a rare and exciting astronomical event, which is going to occur next Tuesday, the transit of Venus. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I think what we need to start with for our listeners is, what is the transit of Venus, Amy?
The transit of Venus is when Venus passes directly in front of the sun from our point of view on Earth.
So not unlike a lunar eclipse?
You could think of it as like a mini, mini, mini eclipse. Venus will look like a small black dot slowly gliding across the face of the sun.
And when is this going to happen?
It's going to happen for us where we are next Tuesday, June 5th, and it starts late in the afternoon, just after 6 p.m., and it'll still be in progress when the sun sets at 8:30 p.m.
So that's about 3 hours to cross, or at least 3 hours from our perspective.
From our point of view, we'll get the first, almost 2.5 hours. We'll miss the end of it.
And what's the significance of this? Why is this an interesting event for people to know about? And we'll go about that in some detail. But give us the heart of the matter.
Right. Well, I would say three main things. One is this is the last chance in our lifetimes to see a transit of Venus, this one on June 5th. Also, there's scientific significance. In the past, it was used to measure the size of the solar system. And then today, scientists use transits of other planets around other stars to find them. It's one way scientists find exoplanets.
Interesting. We'll get to that. So you mentioned that you could measure the distance to in the solar system. Is that the distance from here to the sun? What kind of distances could I measure?
You could measure the distance from Earth to the sun, the other planets to the sun. Thanks to Johannes Kepler in the early 1600s, it was understood what the relative distances of the planets from the sun were. For example, if you considered the Earth-Sun distance to be one astronomical unit, it was known that Venus was 0.72 astronomical units, or AUs, from the sun, and Jupiter was 5 astronomical units. But nobody knew what an astronomical unit was, how many miles.
So how could I use the transit of Venus to find out the distance? So one astronomical unit, that's the distance from here to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
How long is that in miles, by the way?
It's 93 million miles, I'm rounding. Another way to think of it is it takes sunlight just over 8 minutes to get from the sun to Earth, so 8 light minutes.
Yeah, my son learned that in science in school the other day. He likes to remind me that, perhaps the sun was destroyed 6 minutes ago and I don't know about it yet.
That could be. Not likely, but it could be.
Though. So how would I utilize the transit of Venus to measure that distance?
Well, Edmund Halley, for example, of Halley's Comet, had proposed that if people sent out expeditions around the world and observe the transit of Venus by making timings of the transit, you could use that as a way to figure out the distance to Venus and thus the distances of other planets from each other and from the sun.
So how would I translate those timings to the distance? How would that work?
Well, it's trigonometry, but
we're trigonometry friendly here.
Okay, we are. Okay, maybe we should talk about parallax.
Absolutely.
And how parallax works. So this is something that you can try at home, although don't try it if you're driving. But you can experiment with parallax just by holding your thumb in front of your face. If you hold your thumb pretty close to your face.
I'm holding my thumb up.
Okay, good. Now look at your thumb with just one eye, say just your left eye.
Okay.
And now close that eye or cover it with the other hand, and look at your thumb with just the other eye.
Gotcha. All right.
And did your thumb appear to jump or shift against the background?
Yes, it did.
Okay. So try it again, but now hold your thumb way out, maybe all the way extended at arm's length, and do it again. Look at your thumb with just one eye and then the other.
All right. I got it.
And your thumb looked like it jumped again?
It did.
It shifted? Was the shift more or less?
Uh-oh. It's a test. Let me double check. I think it was more.
Oh, you sure it wasn't?
Did I get that wrong?
Less?
Okay, it was definitely less.
It was less, right? Okay,
absolutely.
Good. So by measuring, by knowing the distance between your two eyes, so the two different locations from which you observed, and by measuring the amount of the shift, you can figure out the distance to that object, to your thumb. Well, the same thing can be done by making observations from different locations on Earth and observing a transit of Venus, looking at where Venus is relative to the sun. Or another way to do it is to time it.
And the timing, is that related to the rotation of the Earth during that time?
Well, so Venus takes a certain path across the sun depending on where you are on Earth, and those paths will be different lengths depending on where you observe the transit from.
Some extra trigonometry in there somewhere, I imagine.
There's some fun math involved.
Yeah. Well, in preparing for this show, I did a little research, and I want to share a story with you I came across because I thought this was interesting. In order to get the trigonometry correct, you need to know the radius of the Earth. So I thought, well, geez, when did we learn this? So, and I may butcher this poor man's name, but there was an old Greek mathematician. His name was Eratosthenes, and he lived in the 3rd century BC, and he was interested in calculating the radius of the Earth. Now, you note the significance there right away. This is 18 centuries before Columbus, when at least the popular histories we learned in school said people thought the Earth was flat. Well, here, good old Eratosthenes wants to calculate the radius of the Earth 18 centuries earlier. And then, so in a scene that kind of reminds me of something you might see in an Indiana Jones movie, he notices that during the summer solstice in this little town in Egypt called Syene, the sun shines straight down the well. It just reminds me of that one Indiana Jones movie where he puts that glass lens on the stick and it shines on that little city.
Right. So he knew the sun was directly overhead then.
He did. So then he also had measurements made in Alexandria, and he knew the sun made a 7-degree angle. He knew the distance from Syene to Alexandria, and he calculated the radius of the Earth almost exactly to the right value. I just think that's a great story. And it's also a good illustration, and I think we'll talk more about scientific progress here as the show goes on, that it's not a linear thing. People learn, people forget, things come in fits and starts. So our friend Eratosthenes knew the Earth was round 18 centuries before Columbus. It took us down a little bit of a tangent there, but that's all part of the trigonometry. So you mentioned in the intro, Amy, that this would be perhaps the only chance for us to see a transit in our lifetime. How often do they occur?
Well, they occur in 8-year pairs, though there was one 8 years ago in June of 2004. Tragically, it was cloudy here, so not a lot of people around here actually got to see it. But the 8-year pairs are separated on either side by more than a century. So the people who did get to see the 2004 transit, none of them had seen one before, because the one before that was in 1882. People who see this transit are not likely to see the next one, because it won't happen until 2117.
Okay.
And the bad news is, that's not even visible from North Carolina. The next one visible from North Carolina isn't until 2125. So don't miss this transit of Venus.
Absolutely. Well, we're talking about next Tuesday. So I assume, and we'll talk later about the events at Moorhead that are related to this, but I assume you're already looking at long-range weather forecasts. We've got a tropical storm moving into the area the day that we're recording this. What's it look like?
Well, I did check the forecast, and maybe it's a little early to be obsessing over it, but it does look okay right now for Tuesday, June 5th. So I hope it holds. We're at the planetarium. We're used to being able to control the weather, but in the real sky, it doesn't work so well.
So, Jen, just thinking through, are there other planetary transits that we can see from here, and do we observe those as well?
There are. We can see Mercury transits. So to see a planet crossing in front of the sun, the planet needs to orbit the sun closer in than Earth does, and so only Mercury and Venus do that. Mercury transits the sun more frequently. It works out to be about 13 times per century, but Venus much less common.
So when do we? I'll give you a quick test here. I had to do the thumb test earlier. When is the next transit of Mercury that we can see in the area? Do you know?
I'd have to look it up. I don't actually know.
Fair enough. Well, appreciate the background on that. I see it's time for our first break. This is Jeff Danner with Amy Sale.
You're listening to a special edition of Who's Talking on WCHL with guest host Jeff Danner. And now, substituting for D.G. Martin, once again, here's Jeff Danner.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm here with my guest Amy Sale of Moorhead Planetarium, and we're talking about the transit of Venus. And one thing that struck me over the break, Amy, we had a transit in 2004, and now one next week in 2012. And then you mentioned not again until 2117. It seems odd, sort of a pattern to me. Why is that, or how does it work that it's like that?
Okay, so you might think transits of Venus would happen all the time. So Venus is orbiting the sun. It takes roughly 7 Earth months for Venus to get around the sun. It takes Earth, of course, 1 year. That's the definition of a year, 365 days. And we line up fairly often. Every 1.6 years, Venus passes between Earth and the sun. So you'd think every 1.6 years, we would have a transit of Venus. But the two planets don't orbit in exactly the same plane around the sun. Earth's orbital plane and Venus's orbital plane are inclined by 3.4 degrees. And that means that usually when Venus passes between Earth and the sun, it passes above or below the sun. So it's not this perfect lineup. And every once in a while, it does work out where Venus looks like it passes right in front of the sun.
Are the 2004 and 2012, are they any different? I mean, does one, say, cross the middle and the other one, are they different in their apparent path?
They do. The paths are a little bit different, and you can look on the web and see pictures of what the paths would look like. And, of course, your specific path for where you are on the globe is different than it is from other people observing the same transit. And that, of course, relates to how Venus transits were used to get estimates for the size of the solar system from that parallax effect.
And I think, when we often see depictions of the solar system, I mean, they tend to be two-dimensional. We look at them in a book. Venus's plane is 3.4 degrees out. That seems pretty close. Are the planets in our solar system close to all being the same plane?
The planets are really close to all being in the same plane. And what that means is when you look from Earth at the night sky, you're going to see the planets looking like they're lined up in the sky. So Venus is disappearing right now from the evening sky. But until recently, you would notice Venus, Mars, and Saturn in the early evening sky all looking like they were in this wonderful line. And that's just because they're orbiting in the same plane. It's nothing unusual.
So what you say, so Venus is disappearing right now, but so we can watch it through the evenings up to the transit, or will it be hidden from view between now and Tuesday? Or
it's getting harder and harder. I actually tried to see Venus Monday night from where I live, and it was lost behind the trees, which is something, of course, that happens to us around here in this area. Something's low on the horizon. You might not be able to see it through the trees. It's right Tuesday night. It's setting within an hour of the sun. So it's getting harder and harder because it's setting closer and closer to right after the sun. And then, of course, on Tuesday, it will pass directly in front of the sun. It's on an inside track compared to us, and it's catching up with us and passing us by on June 5th.
So, all right. So now we know what it is, and we know that we can use the transit to measure the distances in the universe, or at least in the solar system, I think is more accurately. And I think let's talk through some of the history of the transit of Venus and its study. It has some good stories and some implications for all of the history. So just the history of science development. It's got some names that the listeners will be familiar with. So I looked up. I wondered, well, when did we start to study the transit of Venus? And so, again, you mentioned Kepler, who we now, I think, mm-hmm. have an orbiting telescope named after. Is that correct?
We do.
So it was the Johannes Kepler, who was a German mathematician born in 1571. I read where in 1627, he predicted there'd be a transit in 1631. So I thought, all right, that was pretty good. Four mm-hmm. years out. I don't know if everyone believed him or not. And he knew what its value would be. But my understanding was they didn't, like as you mentioned, like the 2117 transit won't be visible here in North Carolina.
Right, and that was the tragedy about that 1631 transit. not visible in Europe.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can have this vision of poor Mr. Kepler sitting out and he's got his telescope or he's all ready to go. I don't know where the telescopes were at that time, but no one made any scientific observations at that time.
No. And poor Kepler, he actually died before that transit. So he had no
chance. So I can't envision him out there looking.
And as far as we know, no one observed it anywhere from the world in 1631.
Okay. Good. Well, all right. So let's move then. We move eight years forward to 1639. Where I believe a couple of gentlemen in England did have a chance to look through.
Jeremiah Horrocks, a young astronomer, had a friend, William Crabtree, and they became the first known to observe a Venus transit.
Now, so they were both in England at the time. Were they able to get a decent estimate just from being, I guess they're, you know, the chance point of their. If the parallax effects is my two eyes looking at my thumb, if I've got two guys in England looking past Venus.
My understanding is that Horrocks was able to make some sort of estimate of the astronomical unit, the Sun-Earth distance, based on his observations. It was off by quite a bit, but it was still a shockingly large distance. People didn't realize how big the solar system was. Although I think he was hampered by some bad weather. Being England, it wasn't a clear view of the transit.
Yeah, not known for its cloudy skies. After 1639, there wouldn't be another transit until 1761. And you mentioned, I read an interesting story about Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet. He knew that the transit of Venus was a useful measure, but he also realized he would never live to see one,
right,
not the next one. So he had published a paper on how to measure the distance, and then went out to I like these little coincidences that happen. He goes out to St. Helena, which is people may be familiar. That's where Napoleon lived out his last days on this lonely little island in the middle of the Atlantic, and he tried to make a measurement of the transit of Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
Which I believe is more difficult to extract data from, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, because Mercury is smaller than Venus. It's farther away, so its apparent size is smaller as well. And actually, a transit of Mercury, you can't – we should talk at some point also how to safely view these events. But a transit of Mercury, you would need a magnified view to be able to see. You can't just see it with your unaided eye like you can a transit of Venus. And again, I'm sure we'll talk later about not looking directly at the sun.
Well, yeah, if you want to do a little public service announcement right here as we're on it. I mean, is it the same as, again, similar to an eclipse?
Right. So there was actually an eclipse recently, an annular eclipse not visible here, but I got to see it out in Utah. And we had these nifty eclipse glasses, which we will have at Moorhead Planetarium for our event to hand out for free to people. But eclipse glasses they're not ordinary sunglasses at all. They're made of a very special kind of material that pretty much all you see when you put them on is the sun. I've been doing some ambush astronomy, I like to call it, lately, and testing out these eclipse glasses. And this is what happens. Somebody puts them on, they say, I can't see anything. And then they tilt their head up toward the sun and they say, oh, that's it. I see it. And you see the ball of the sun. It's really cool. And we actually, the other day, we saw a large sunspot just using the eclipse glasses. And this is not a magnified view. So we're expecting to see that black dot of Venus during the transit on June 5th with just the eclipse glasses. We'll have other methods available as well.
Thank you for that. We'll touch on that again. So back to our friend, Mr. Halley. So he died in 1742. So I envision him trying to hold on to 1761. He didn't quite make it. But then 1761 and 1769 were the next pair, and these are the most famous. As my readers of my column know, I'm an engineer myself and a scientist, and so I enjoy these history of science stories. And 1761, I think, is a great model of the first situation where there was international scientific cooperation, at least on a large scale. So they sent out expeditions with scientists from Britain, Austria, and France. And then let me just check my list here. They sent them to Siberia, Newfoundland, Norway, Madagascar, and South Africa, which I think, you know, it's kind of a nice thought of them cooperating and all these ships going out to get these measurements from around the world, which would improve their calculations, presumably.
Yeah, and there's some really interesting stories.
Well, one of those interesting stories was 1769 was the first voyage of Captain James Cook. And so he got to go to Tahiti to check out the transit of Venus, which is pretty good duty, I think. And he went there, and the observations were only partially successful. Again, he had some cloud cover.
Mm-hmm.
But what I thought was interesting was, first of all, they didn't want him to get sidetracked or the crew to get sidetracked. And many of them thought going to make this observation of this scientific event was not particularly interesting. So the rest of his orders were sealed in an envelope. He wasn't allowed to look at them until they completed their scientific observations. So I like that prioritization for the science. But just a couple of things I thought were interesting on that voyage. This was the first ship to circumvent the world without losing a man to scurvy. And the other thing was William Bligh was an officer on that ship. And for those who've seen the movie Mutiny on the Bounty, Bligh was the captain of the Bounty when it went back to Tahiti, looking actually for Bligh goes back to try to get samples of breadfruit in his assignments to take them back to the Caribbean to feed the slave labor there. But again, just lots of different things crossing past there. And then on their way home at the end of the voyage, they stopped in St. Helena again. So perhaps they could commune with the spirit of Edmund Halley. But I see it's time for our second break. And this is Jeff Danner, substituting for D.G. Martin on Who's Talking with my guest Amy Sale of the Moorhead Planetarium. And we'll be back after these messages.
You're listening to a special edition of Who's Talking on WCHL with guest host Jeff Danner. And now, substituting for D.G. Martin, once again, here's Jeff Danner.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm here with my guest, Amy Sale of the Moorhead Planetarium, and we're talking about the transit of Venus. So I think there's just one more really fascinating story from the transits of 1761 and 1769 that I think our listeners just need to hear. It's a story of a dedicated scientist who ends up with kind of a tragic end. So I'll give you a little bit of a foreshadowing there. So one of the scientists I mentioned, the international cooperation that went out in 1761, was a scientist from France. His name was Guillaume Le Gentil. He was an accomplished astronomer, and he was part of the 1761 scientific expedition. And he was headed to a French colony in India called Pondicherry, which I think is a good name. Kind of gotta give them a credit for those creativity. So he leaves France in March of 1760, and then he arrives in the Indian Ocean at what was then called Isle de France. That's now Mauritius, famous as being the home of the dodo bird. He gets there in July, and he's got to go to India, but then he finds out, while I've been on the boat, England and France have gone to war, and the English have taken over the coast. So he decides, well, I've come all this way, so he tries to go there anyway, and he gets turned back. So by the time the transit is occurring on June 6th, 1761, it's a beautiful, clear day. He's sailing across the Indian Ocean. He's watching the transit. But, of course, the boat's bouncing around in the water, and so he can't take any measurements, as you could imagine. So undeterred, Le Gentil decides, okay, well, I only have to wait another 8 years. I don't know how he manages, mills about the Indian Ocean for another 8 years. He maps the coast of Madagascar. He visits some places. And then he decides, well, okay, I think the greatest place to watch the transit in 1769 is in Manila. So he heads to the Philippines. Well, of course, the Philippines are taken over by the Spanish. There's another international incidents and diplomatic tensions, so he can't land there. So he has to quick sail back across the Indian Ocean, back to the coast of India. And he gets back to Pondicherry, where he was supposed to get there in 1761. The English and the French had a peace treaty, and now he can go there. So he arrives there 15 months ahead of schedule. He builds an observatory, and he waits. And I think you can see what's about to come, right?
I think there's bad news on the way.
There is bad news on the way. He sits there, and every day for a month, it's beautiful weather on the coast of India, pure sunshine, and he's waiting and waiting and waiting. And then just on the morning of July 4th, 1769, when he's supposed to be seeing this transit that he's been waiting for and waiting for, the clouds roll in. Not what's going to happen at Moorhead on Tuesday.
No, that's not allowed.
But the clouds roll in, and he can't see anything. The reports from his comrades that this just drives him insane. He heads to his bed for a while, and he says, okay, I'm going to head home. He gets dysentery. His boat gets stranded at a little island in the Indian Ocean where he has to wait for another year and a half for a ship. So finally, 11 years later in 1771, he gets back to France.
And are things better then?
Things are not. He finds that he's been declared dead, his wife is remarried, and his relatives have plundered all of his wealth and his estates. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, science was a lot harder back then.
I know. To observe this Venus transit, all you have to do is come on out somewhere where there's a viewing event. No dysentery, none of that.
So I appreciate you letting me share with you my story of Le Gentil. I read that a few years ago, and I really enjoy that. So that's what was happening in 1761 and 1769, and I believe the 1769 measurements, which were taken from a number of other locations, obviously not Pondicherry, India, did get a pretty good estimate of the distance to the sun.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Pretty good estimate by that point.
So then, you know, there were further transits in 1874 and 1882, but let's move forward now. I mean, how are we utilizing and studying the transits of Venus at this point to continue our pursuit of knowledge and science?
Okay, well, obviously we know the size of the solar system now. We don't need to use a transit of Venus to get that information. However, there is a global experiment going on where anyone who has a smartphone can download a transit of Venus phone app.
And I just go to the app store and I put in transit of Venus?
Well, I don't have one of those phones myself, but I know that if you go to this website that's called transitofvenus.org,
okay,
you can get to a link that where you can get the information that you need. And you can practice in advance before the transit, timing the transit of Venus. And then during the transit itself, you can time the transit from where you are and submit your data. And it's going to be part of this global database to remeasure the size of the solar system. And of course, we have very accurate measurements from methods like radar ranging, but it's still a fun thing to do.
Well, it's a great way to get everybody engaged and involved. And I mean, I think you're doing just what Le Gentil was trying to do back in 1769, is get your measurements from where you are.
Yeah, much easier this way, I think.
Yes.
And then, of course, transits are used in other ways, too, by scientists as one of the ways of discovering planets orbiting around other stars.
How would you do that?
So, for example, NASA's Kepler space mission. This is a space-based telescope. It's within our own solar system. It's actually trailing Earth in its orbit. It is pointed at a particular part of the Milky Way galaxy, and it is staring continuously at more than 150,000 stars. And what it's looking for is to see if any of those stars' light dims just a little bit in such a way that would indicate that a planet is transiting or passing in front of its parent star.
I'm assuming so it looks at the amount it dims. I mean, if it were just a little asteroid or something, the dimming would be pretty minor, so you could see a planet would be a larger one.
It's easier for Kepler to detect larger planets that are orbiting close to their parent stars, but it's one of its main goals is actually to look for Earth-sized planets that could be orbiting their parent stars within the habitable zone, so a distance at which water could be liquid on the planet's surface.
So, and do you have an idea how many Earth-sized planets have they found in the habitable zone of these 150,000 stars?
Last I heard, no Earth-sized planets found in habitable zones. However, planets found within their habitable zone and Earth-sized planets found.
Oh, okay.
But it's still collecting data. The mission was only launched 3 years ago, and it needs three transits to actually confirm a planet as being a confirmed planet. So,
So it would take the Kepler telescope about 120 years to determine that Venus was there? It strikes me.
I'd have to think about that. Yeah. Well, to determine a planet like Earth, you would need 3 years three transits.
Yeah.
The Kepler mission and other studies as well have so far, the last planet count I heard was 691 confirmed planets, but hundreds of more planet candidates.
Mm-hmm. And do you know, did they pick this region of the Milky Way because they thought it might be rich in planets or just a high concentration of stars to shine the or to direct the telescope to?
They picked – it's a region you can actually see in tonight's sky if it's clear. It's in the direction of the constellation Cygnus, kind of between Cygnus and overlapping with Lyra. And this is in the vicinity of the Summer Triangle, three bright stars that are pretty much rising as it starts to get dark at this time of year. And it's looking at that part of the sky because it's a very star-rich field. Also, it is in a part of the sky where Kepler can continuously observe that part of the sky without getting interference from the sun. And it's looking at particular distances and essentially just trying to take a census, trying to answer the question of how common are planets around other stars, and specifically Earth-like planets.
Interesting. Well, I see that it's time for our next break. This is Jeff Danner substituting for D.G. Martin on Who's Talking with my guest Amy Sale of Moorhead Planetarium, and we are talking about the transit of Venus and other...
You're listening to a special edition of Who's Talking on WCHL with guest host Jeff Danner. And now, substituting for D.G. Martin, once again, here's Jeff Danner.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm here with my guest, Amy Sale of the Moorhead Planetarium. And so, Amy, we've gone through, we now understand what the transit of Venus is and how I can use it to measure the distance of things in the solar system. It's kind of fascinating history. Now I and I'm sure the listeners are interested to know, okay, how can I experience the transit at Moorhead next week? What's going on?
Well, we are going to have a big event. So this is Tuesday, June 5th, and our event will start at 5:30 p.m. and will go until sunset at 8:30. The transit itself actually starts just after 6 p.m. And this is a family science event, but everyone is welcome. All ages will have something to do. We're going to have safe solar viewing, because to see that black dot of Venus, that silhouette on the sun, you have to look at the sun. So we're going to have eclipse glasses, solar telescopes brought by members of the Chapel Hill Astronomical and Observational Society. Chaos. And we're also
name.
That's a good name, yes. And we're also planning the Moorhead Observatory. Dr. Dan Reichart, the director, has arranged for a solar filter to be placed on the Moorhead telescope and a webcam. So we're going to be beaming views, hopefully, if the weather permits, live views of the transit into the planetarium, full dome theater, and into our science stage as well. So
Will I be online or just just locally there at the site, the webcam images?
I'm not sure. Definitely at the site, and not sure. And we will, we're going to watch this transit no matter what. So even if it's raining, we are still having our event. We will watch this thing on the internet if we have to.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's assume for the moment you've got good weather and you've got your guests there and their eclipse glasses. Where are they going to be in the parking lot out front of the planetarium? Where were they gathered to watch?
We'll probably have at least one solar telescope out in the parking lot in the eastern end of the lot. We should be able to follow the transit till 7 or 7:30 p.m. And then if we have a tree and building problem. But up on the east end of our building, where the Moorhead Observatory is, there's an observing deck where, if the weather permits, we should be able to follow the transit till about 8 p.m., so fairly close to sunset. And so people can go up there. They can also take tours of the Moorhead Observatory and see the big telescope in action.
And so, you mentioned earlier there'd be events for people of different ages. Other than the viewing of the transit itself, what's going on Tuesday?
There'll be a lot going on. We're going to have planetarium shows every half hour. These will be short live shows where you can learn about what the transit is and how scientists use transits now to find exoplanets. And we'll take advantage of our full dome system so that, you know, it looks like we're lifting off Earth. We're looking back at the solar system so people can really get a good 3D view of and really understand what's going on. We're also going to have presentations in our science stage by a couple of NASA JPL solar system ambassadors. Mike Malaska and Tony Rice are going to be talking about NASA's solar missions and about Venus itself, how the sun works, how transits are used to hunt for exoplanets. And we'll have lots of other hands-on activity stations as well.
Is there a limit to the number of people who can come?
We can seat a lot of people in the theater and the science stage and at all those stations and the observatory and the parking lot. So everybody's welcome to come on out.
Yeah. So just as a reminder, you know, for your prioritization, if you don't go to Moorhead on Tuesday, you've got to wait till 21:17 for the next one.
Right. 21:25 if you want to see it from North Carolina.
That's a good point. You'll have to travel halfway across the globe, perhaps to Manila or Pondicherry to see it in 21:17. So I would certainly encourage everyone to get out there. So, Amy, I've sort of let you off the hook. I often ask all my other guests a little bit more about their job. So now that we know to come to Morehead on Tuesday evening, just what else are your responsibilities at Morehead as the current science program manager?
Well, in addition to organizing this event with our fabulous intern, Addie Jo Schoenwolf, I give some of the shows in the planetarium, especially some of the live programming, Carolina Skies, and I manage our science stage where we have...
Are there any new shows upcoming at Morehead?
Oh, yeah, we do have a new show, One World, One Sky, and it features Big Bird and Sesame Street characters, and it's aimed at ages 4 and up.
Nice. And then, I'm sorry to interrupt, you were on the science stage. Tell me about that.
So we have live demonstration shows that go on, and we also have programs we call Science 360. So, for example, we have a show running this summer called The Truth Behind 2012, and that examines some of the most common claims, apocalyptic claims that have been made about how the world will end on December 21st, 2012. So we look at those claims and debunk them.
Oh, so we're safe? We're likely to survive the year from the perspective of Morehead?
It looks like we will. In fact, I'm working on developing a special live planetarium show to have on December 21st, which is very conveniently a Friday evening, called Carolina Skies End of the World Edition.
That's a great name.
We've been joking that on December 22nd, we might want to run Carolina Skies We Told You So Edition.
Well, because is it the December 21st? That's the date that's predicted from the Mayan calendar?
Right. So the Mayan, there's a long count calendar that runs out. Of course, it would just, you'd start over with a new calendar, just like when we get to December 31st, time does not end. We start over with January 1st again. But some people have really jumped on this and have made all sorts of claims about how the planets are going to align and Earth's magnetic field will reverse somehow on that day, and that all these things will happen. And either the things that they're claiming aren't going to happen, or even if they are going to happen, it doesn't actually have any bad effects.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing to worry about.
It's good to know. And I think, do I recall you run a program down at Lake Jordan out of Morehead?
Our skywatching sessions, yeah. About every month we go out to Jordan Lake and have free skywatching sessions for the public. So we were actually originally planning to have this transit of Venus session out there.
I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
Because Jordan Lake, looking out over the water, of course, we have this fantastic western horizon. So we could have followed it, you know, down to sunset. But by moving that session to the Morehead Planetarium building, that gives us so many other, it gives us rain or shine options, and then also allows us to do a lot of other educational activities as well. But we will be at Jordan Lake in June, mm-hmm. June 23rd, a Saturday night.
And just have different speakers come through and do the constellation reviews? What would I see if I...
So if you go, so you just go, you don't have to sign up or anything, and it's at Ebenezer Church Recreation Area at Jordan Lake, and we have a number of telescopes there. Morehead owns some telescopes that we bring out, but we really rely on that on the Chapel Hill Astronomy Club, CHAOS, to their members volunteer with telescopes. And we often get folks from the Raleigh Astronomy Club as well help us out. And the public comes out and can look through the scopes. We look at a variety of objects over the evening. And we also do constellation tours with a green laser. It looks like you're pointing right to the stars. It's incredible. And we might tell some stories and that kind of thing.
And I'm assuming, in addition to having the space and the lake and the beautiful scenery, you know, for a nighttime viewing session, being at Jordan Lake is a sort of a reduced light pollution situation. For an evening affair of watching the transit, does that come into play at all, or are you really just you're watching the black dot move across the sun?
Right. For the transit, it's, you know, by definition a daytime event, so lights are not an issue. It's mainly what kind of horizon you have, whether you have trees and buildings in the way. And then, of course, you must have a safe way to look at the sun, the special eclipse glasses, or we should definitely say something about telescopes. You can use a telescope to look at the sun only if it's a solar telescope, a telescope that's made for looking at the sun, or if you have proper solar filters that are properly attached.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it will be the last thing you ever see.
Nothing. I would assume particularly through a telescope.
Yeah. And we actually, with eclipse glasses, if you have eclipse glasses, they are made to be used as a standalone thing. They should not be used with binoculars or a telescope. When I was out watching the annular eclipse in Utah, we took some binoculars, held the eclipse glasses in front of them as if a person was wearing the eclipse glasses and then holding binoculars up to their eyes. Mm-hmm. And the binoculars collected the light and focused it in such a way that they burned holes through the eclipse glasses in a fraction of a second. Imagine what that would do to your eyes. So eclipse glasses must be used standalone, and binoculars and telescopes can be used only if they have solar filters properly used.
Well, so it brings up a question. So you'll be providing the eclipse glasses to the people who were there. But for someone who's listening and can't get to Moorhead on Tuesday night, is this something one could buy?
Where would you can buy them. I have to say there's been a run on eclipse glasses because of the transit and because of that annular eclipse that was visible in much of the country on May 20th. So I checked the manufacturer that I like the best, and they are currently out. So I hope people will make it to our event where they can get them for free. Or they could try to order them online, see if they're available. Or they can check to see if there's an event in their location. Mm-hmm. There's a NASA website that is compiling a list of transit of Venus events around the country. And there are other events happening.
That's good to know. Well, I see, unfortunately, we're out of time, Amy. But thank you for coming in today and walking through the transit of Venus with us. And giving everybody the great suggestion to get on down to Moorhead on Tuesday night. And see an astronomical event of their lifetime. So thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.